Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, wolves are no longer the evil beasts portrayed in Little Red Riding Hood. Today, wolf recovery programs are being considered in all parts of the United States. Author Kent Nerburn greets the first snows in wolf country in Minnesota. We speak with Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman upon his return from the World Food Conference in Rome. And right whales are heading for warm waters in Georgia. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Wolves once roamed over most of North America, but nearly all were killed at the hands of humans. Until quite recently, it was an accepted and encouraged practice in most places to exterminate the wolf. They were seen as threats to livestock, wild game, and public safety. Today, we're working hard to bring the wolf back. Recently, wolf experts from all over the United States gathered in Albany, New York, to discuss their efforts to speed wolf recovery. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
In Little Red Riding Hood, the big bad wolf eats Grandma and tries to make the story's namesake dessert. In The Three Little Pigs, a gluttonous wolf blows down houses going after dinner. These kind of stories have been told for centuries, but you won't hear them here at the annual wolf conference. Roger Schlickhuysen is the president of Defenders of Wildlife. He located the conference in Albany, New York, to make the case for returning wolves to the Adirondack Mountains in the northern part of the state.
Well, if you look at wolf recovery in the United States, kind of like a plane taking off, I think we've already had liftoff. I think liftoff occurred when we got the wolves back into Yellowstone and central Idaho. And now it's beginning the ascent, and it's rising faster now. And I think there is probably no statement that could be made that better benefited wolf conservation initially and all wildlife conservation eventually than one that could be made by New York, with the citizens of New York voluntarily saying that they want to return the wolf to their state. And I think that's a real possibility now.
A wolf recovery program in New York has the advantage of being the most recent in a spate of such programs. The first wolf to be reintroduced was the red wolf, native to the southeastern United States. It was extinct in the wild before the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began a reintroduction effort 9 years ago in a vast wilderness area in eastern North Carolina. Jennifer Gilbreth is with the Fish and Wildlife Service. She says the progress has been slow but fruitful.
The red wolf was declared extinct in the wild in 1980. About 14 red wolves were captured in the southeastern United States. They were the remaining population. They were bred in captivity. Fortunately, wolves will breed relatively well in captivity. And in 1987, a release program was initiated on Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. And this was the first attempt ever to restore a carnivore species declared extinct in the wild. And it's been a biological success, so we feel like a real flagship for lots of endangered and threatened species.
The red wolves have the advantage of living in a wild area nearly detached from civilization. But in Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, the wolf recovery project has not been so easy. There, wolves will likely roam well outside the park boundaries, and some local residents fear livestock and their safety will be threatened. Mike Phillips directs Yellowstone's program for the Park Service. He says the gray wolf population he oversees will be closely monitored.
The fact is, wolves living on private land in and of itself shouldn't be a problem. In this country, wildlife are publicly owned. A landowner cannot unilaterally decide, I don't want wolves on my property, I don't want rabbits on my property, I don't want deer on my property. It doesn't work that way. And so just the mere presence of a wolf isn't a problem. Now, if the wolf causes a definable problem, it kills a cow, it kills a sheep, it knocks over a garbage can, it becomes a genuine nuisance, then we have the means by which to stop that problem.
The one place in this country where the wolves need no reintroduction is in the upper Midwest. Adrian Whiteven is with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He says although Wisconsin has relatively few wilderness areas, wolves are barely noticed by most people.
There's some minor depredation that it does occur on livestock. Normally we have maybe one or two cases per year, but it's not very frequent. In the last 16 years, we've had only, I think, 15 or 16 cases of depredation. Although individual cases may, in some cases, be a lot of animals because we had one wolf that killed 100 turkeys. But in general, the frequency of depredation is quite low. Impact on deer herds, 100 wolves in Wisconsin would probably utilize about 1,800, 2,000 deer. Our state deer population is about 1.5 million, so it's a very minor portion of the deer population.
In the Southwest, a program to restore the critically endangered Mexican wolf may get going sometime next year. The recovery program will be carried out by both the U.S. and Mexican governments. David Parsons is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says the program is a radical change from the past.
In fact, it was ironically the precursor agency to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which was called then the U.S. Biological Survey, that was the agency that removed wolves, that operated the control program for wolves at that time. That was the politically correct thing to do at that time, and we did a damn fine job of it and essentially removed all the wolves from the Southwest.
Parsons and others in the government say it's important to bring the wolf back because in many cases it's required under the Endangered Species Act. The fact that wolves occasionally cause minor trouble is not enough to keep them from being reintroduced. Dr. William Weber is with the Wildlife Conservation Society. He says Americans need to make sacrifices for predators like wolves.
If we expect Indians to live with tigers and Latin Americans to live with jaguars, then we can't keep fighting the reintroduction of the wolf. And I think we really have to stand up and demonstrate a much higher form of leadership. We really have to try and set some kind of example in this country for conservation. If we don't, if we can't do a better job of managing our parks, of protecting our ecosystems, then we really can't expect the world's poorest countries and really the poorest of the poor, the people living around those protected areas, to continue to make the sacrifices they are for the greater good and conservation.
Wolf attacks on humans are almost unheard of. You're more likely to get hit by a meteorite. By comparison, domestic dogs kill more than 20 persons each year. Ecologists say the benefits far outweigh the risks. They say wolves are an integral part of the ecosystem, but it's an open question whether populations will continue to grow, the limiting factor being the level of human acceptance. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
With the help of biologists, federal and state officials, and vociferous supporters and opponents across the land, the wolf is coming back to America. In some places, it's reintroduced at great cost and effort. But in northern Minnesota, the wolf was never completely driven out. Kent Nurburn paints a portrait of that land as it looks in this season and tells us what the first snow means to him. He reads the story Benediction, which is published in his new book, A Haunting Reverence: Meditations on a Northern Land.
The snow came last night. She left before the dawn, bestowing in her wake a benediction upon the earth. Now, in morning light, she greets us gently, a prayer shawl donned upon the land. Here and there a whirling gust, whipped up by some angry and isolated wind, rises tiny and intense, like a petulant child trying to start a fight. But this is not his day. The world is silent and at peace, and the tracks and markings we have made upon the earth, the endless measurements and passages, are again forgiven. I hold my breath, all is white and still. The pines stand in steepled reverence against the sky. The elms reach out their fingers in naked supplication. And the birch, kindred spirits to the winter earth, show off their white and graceful elegance against the mantle of their sister snow. Far in the distance, the thin line of forest is a lacework tracery, flashing diamonds of crystal light against the cold brilliance of the day. A fox braves the brightness of the morning sun and rushes across the fresh eternity for a moment immortal, like the first shooting star that ever cut across an evening sky. He bounds and scrabbles, crazed by his blind exposure, then disappears into the distant woods. But he is not followed. This is not a time of hunting. The world still wakes in gentle wonder. It is not yet a time of passions and of fears. It makes the heart gentle, this snow, burying the sharp edges of life and cutting us off from time. Our traces on the surface of the land are gone, our lives devoid of history once more. All is singular, all is one. We are children at the dawn of time. Begin again, begin again. This snowfall says, begin again. It is the purest absolution, and falls in vast forgiveness on us all.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we hear from Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman upon his return from the World Food Conference in Rome. And right whales head for Georgia and shed their blubber. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Last week, the World Food Summit Conference was held under the auspices of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. 22 years ago, at a similar gathering, Henry Kissinger, representing the United States, all but proclaimed that world hunger would be brought to an end in a decade. Unfortunately, hunger persists, and according to figures released by the World Watch Institute, things are worse now than they were then. World population has increased from 4 billion to 5.8 billion. World fish catch has stopped expanding, and many fisheries are badly depleted. Expansion of the world grain harvest is a fraction of what it was. Populations in Asia, growing in number and affluence, are putting incredible pressure on all natural systems that are necessary to produce food. Water and farmland is in increasingly short supply. Leading the American delegation at Rome was United States Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman. We asked him what message he brought to the delegates.
Well, the United States has been the primary and leading supplier of food aid and technical assistance to the world since the Second World War, and we are committed to continue that food aid and food assistance, but we are predicating our future involvement on an effort to try to get individual countries to improve their political and economic and agricultural systems so that they can become more self-sufficient, that the world just can't rely on gifts of food forever. While we are there to provide humanitarian assistance when needed, the goal is try to get more countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, to become more food self-sufficient, which means technical assistance, agricultural reforms, and necessary infrastructure to get that done.
Secretary Glickman takes some solace in the fact that despite the fact that population is 30% more than at the last summit, the actual number of malnutritious people is about the same as it was 25 years ago. He cautions that there is no single solution.
There are several answers to try to increase food production. One of the things, of course, is the use of science, sound science, and biotechnology, whereby what you're able to do is to develop crops that are more pest-resistant, more able to produce the same amount of production with far less water, using sustainable agricultural techniques in the process, all sorts of what I call science enhancements to increase yields and to decrease the use of water and pesticides and herbicides. Now, that has become somewhat controversial because the new science involves the use of biotechnology, the same way medicine has involved biotechnology, whereby, you know, we do a variety of genetic work and other kinds of biotechnological work to get that done. But I do not believe that there is any way that we're going to feed another 2.5 or 3 billion people in this world without going down that road. The alternative to that is to tear up, land that shouldn't ever be produced, tear up rainforests, tear up, the soil, and just have an absolute disaster on our hands.
One debate that surfaces in all discussions about food production today is the role of bioengineering, that process by which genes are transferred in the laboratory across biological barriers to produce the superplant that may be higher yielding, pesticide resistant, or able to grow with less water. Here is Secretary Glickman's take.
You just can't put all your eggs in one basket. What I tend to find as I look at this problem is some people in industry see the only answer is in, let's say, biotechnological improvements in row crops, and then some people on the other side of the ledger in the environmental community see all of the answer in, let's say, sustainable agriculture techniques. Well, the truth is you probably need a blend of both ways of thinking in order to make any real dent on world hunger.
Dan Glickman is the United States Secretary of Agriculture. An environmentalist who has the skepticism about biotechnology that Glickman describes is Margaret Mellon, the Director of Agriculture and Biotechnology Program at the nonprofit organization Union of Concerned Scientists. She cautions that biotechnology is not the silver bullet, and there are other more effective ways to increase food production, particularly in Africa.
Well, I think we need to invest right now in a much larger way than we're currently doing in agricultural research that is targeted to help the developing countries of the world to produce their own food. That's the first and the most important thing that we need to do, and I think that research, that the agenda of that research investment ought to concentrate on infrastructure, on using traditional breeding, on recovering lost agricultural biodiversity as a basis for increasing agricultural productivity. We also need to develop an ability to bring cheap fertilizers to developing countries. That would be another part of the pie. I think, in addition, we want to think about some of our trade policies and whether the industrialized countries ought to continue to subsidize their own agricultures in such a way as to produce very depressed commodity prices that have the effect of driving farmers off the farm in other parts of the world.
Debate at the World Food Conference emphasized once again that hunger, like the environment itself, has many facets: population growth, climate, land and stewardship, plant and animal genetics, seed, fertilizer, trade, political organization, transportation, pollution, culture, and more. Perhaps we need to attack it not with a silver bullet, but with silver buckshot. The Environment Show is going interactive in a new segment called Talking Green. We want to hear from you about environmental issues. Call us or email us, and we might ask you to join us on the air. Our phone number is 1-800-323-9262, extension 600. That's 1-800-323-9262, extension 600. You can email us at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. In our last Talking Green segment, we heard from listeners and a panel of experts about the effects of mountain biking on the environment. In response, one listener, John McDonald, a student at the University of Massachusetts, writes, Mountain biking is certainly good exercise and a great entertainment. But this sport is just another example of how this country views the bicycle as a toy rather than a cheap, efficient source of transportation. There are almost always no racks at workplaces or safe paths for commuting. Most of the world's people regard the bicycle as transportation first and a plaything second. This attitude is just one of the ways our affluence and comfort have undermined so-called common sense. And the Sierra Club writes, "The Sierra Club reaffirms its support for the prohibition of mechanized modes of transportation, including mountain bikes, from entry into designated wilderness. They say the trails should be studied and periodically checked to see if they are suitable for mountain bikes. If significant damage has occurred, the trail should be closed." You can check our webpage for current topics. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Pregnant right whales are now departing from their summer feeding grounds off Nova Scotia and heading for warmer waters. Sarah Mitchell is with the Grays Reef National Marine Sanctuary in Georgia.
They leave the areas around Nova Scotia and New England, and they start a migration all the way down the east coast of the United States, ending up around the Georgia-Florida border. So they would start leaving now, and some of them will start arriving in the next week or so in this area, and some won't arrive until the middle or the end of December. And they'll stay down here until March or sometimes early April, and then they'll swim back north up the coast with their calves. And that also teaches the calf what the path is to come down. So we think that that's also part of the learning process of the mothers teaching the young.
While we know where the pregnant right whales go, Mitchell says we have no idea where the males, juveniles, and non-pregnant females go. Only about 300 of these whales remain in the Northern Hemisphere after having been hunted extensively in the 19th century, so tracking them is no easy task.
It's really surprising how little we know about where the non-pregnant females and the adult males and most of the juveniles go in the winter. Here we have approximately 300 of these animals that are 45 to 50 feet long and weigh about 40 tons, and they simply disappear, and they do it every single year. So we truly have no clue about where they're ending up. There are no historical records of where they have been seen, and we're just now beginning to, with studies through the New England Aquarium, tag some of these animals so that we'll be able to see an annual cycle.
Mitchell says the females choose the waters off Georgia and Florida because the water is warm and calm. This is important for the calves, who haven't developed a blubber layer to keep them warm. They'll feed on their mother's milk, which contains the most fat and calories of any mammal species. The problem with the area is there is very little food for the mothers.
Once the mothers stop feeding, or the pregnant females stop feeding when they leave the Nova Scotia Bay of Fundy area, and we don't have any records of them feeding until they go back up the following April. So here you have this very large marine mammal. They might weigh 40 tons, and they're eating nothing or close to nothing from November until April. So it's very remarkable for a mammal of that size to be able to do that. The other thing is, since the waters are warmer in this area, they actually need to shed some of that blubber so that they won't overheat. Whales don't have sweat glands like we do, and they actually could get too warm inside and cause as many problems as if we overheat.
In stark contrast to the calving right whales, my friends in Georgia spent a lot of time this season gorging themselves around the holiday dinner table. They seem unable to shed blubber the way the whales do. But of course, if whales had relatives that had been taught by humans to give them fruitcakes, they might not lose weight either. They would say that they learned from the landlubber that their blubber comes from grandmother. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burling. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 360. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is the producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.